Well, greetings to all of you. I'm really looking forward to this day and evening of reminiscing. And this is a very special Sabbath. There are people who God has called into His church, but who decide at some point that they will stay at home rather than attending a church service. I call that the living room church of God. Now, the justification for that often has been that they can get almost as much benefit at home as they could by going to a church service. They can listen to sermons, they can sing, they can pray, they can study. And I largely agree with that. But the biggest difference is they are not giving to anyone else. And what we're able to give to others when we come to a church service is just as important, or maybe more important, than what we get or receive from a church service. So what is it that we can give to one another at a church? Well, we give love. But I want to focus on a particular way of showing love, and that is by giving comfort, encouragement, and support to our fellow brethren. And by my introduction, I don't mean that that's the only time we can give encouragement and comfort to others, but certainly that is one of the prime times when we can give to others. The world is full of suffering people, and God's people suffer most of the same kinds of trials that people do outside the church. We have acute health problems, chronic health problems, death of loved ones, premature deaths, job problems, financial problems, and even tragedies, heartbreaking calamities in our lives. And so what goes through our minds when we see those problems, and how do we respond to our own trials, and in particular to the trials that other people are going through? Well, the title of the sermon is Give Comfort, Encouragement, and Support, and How to Give Those Things and How Not to Give Those Things. And, of course, comfort, encouragement, and support also includes similar words like sympathy, empathy, compassion, assistance, support, service. There's many ways to show love in those ways. If you are in God's church, you generally have fewer trials of some types, but you probably have more trials of other types, such as religious persecution. But that's not really the important thing. The important point is that we all do suffer many kinds of trials, and some of them are major trials in life. And so why does God allow suffering among His own people, His own chosen people? Why? This question comes up in everybody's life, and to some people it is an excruciating question at times. We have a wonderful booklet. United Church of God has a booklet called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And I highly recommend it if you haven't read it. And especially if you are suffering or your loved ones are suffering, it's a good time to read it. However, the booklet doesn't cover all the answers. There is nowhere you can go in the Bible to turn to a few places and say, okay, here's all the answers. It's almost like the answers are sprinkled a little here and a little there all through the Bible. And the more we understand the entire Bible, the more we can kind of piece together the many, many things that God has to consider when He does allow suffering. And it can be many different factors. I also read a very important book right here called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. It's not a new book. In fact, it was published in 1981. But I had never read it until this past week. And it was very thought-provoking and informative and inspiring. And I certainly recommend it. Only sad thing about it, it was written by a Jewish rabbi. So he has a very good understanding of the Old Testament, but he doesn't include anything from the New Testament. But certainly has a great amount of insights into this subject. Now, the subject of my sermon is not why does God allow suffering. That would be a good subject for another sermon by someone. But I'm going to quickly mention six things just so that we're on the same page about this. So this is a very condensed, quick 6 points to the question of why does God allow suffering. Number one, God has given us the freedom to choose, to make our own choices, free moral agencies. And so that means we experience the consequences of our own actions and what happens around us. And that's necessary to God's plan for us to build character. Number two, this is not God's world in a sense. It is Satan's world until Jesus Christ returns. Number three, God wants us to focus more on the next life, seeking first the kingdom of God and not expect to have things perfect in this life by any means. But in fact, our sufferings can make us long for the return of Christ and the resurrection and for all the problems to be solved. Number four, God has many ways to make bad things work together for good in the long run. The things that happen to us are not all good. Some are the very bad things. And God is not trying to get you to think that what is bad is really good. But yet God has amazing ways of following those bad things up with good results from those in the long run. Number five, God will do what is best for us spiritually more than physically. In other words, when God has a choice between what is best for this person physically and what is best for this person spiritually, he's going to choose what is best spiritually. Number six, God is going to choose what is best in the long run versus what is best in the short run. He looks way ahead, considers a long-range view, and that will determine what he allows to happen. Now, Ecclesiastes 9:11 says, time and chance happen to them all. And that just means that many things happen just at random, seemingly. And we wonder, well, does that apply to those of us in the church? Now, the fact that it says time and chance happens to us all means that life is not going to be fair. I think we all know this life is not fair. We should not expect things to be fair even in our lives. And even King David, in some of the Psalms, expresses that thought, wondering why God's people seem sometimes to suffer more than the evil people. He sees evil people prospering and righteous people suffering and expresses wonderment and bewilderment at that. And we do too. But this is a universal thing. Even Jesus Christ, when he was on the stake dying, cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? And so most people at some time in their lives feel that way. But does time and chance happen to us? I think yes and no. For those of us who have been called by God, God is much more focused on us, much more involved in our lives. Because after all, we are God's children. And he is our Father. And Jesus Christ is our elder brother. And they're going to be intensely involved in our lives. So God is involved to give us guidance and help and comfort, and sometimes miracles. But you've heard the expression helicopter parent. That is a parent who just hovers over a child, being so overly protective that I'm not going to let anything bad happen to my child, and I'm going to try to steer the child every step he takes and try to shield him from mistakes and bad things. Well, God is not a helicopter God. God is not a helicopter God. He allows natural circumstances and consequences to happen in our lives. And just like it's not good for a child to have a helicopter parent, especially clear through the teenage years, it would not be good for us spiritually if God were shielding us constantly from anything bad. So he's not an invisible shield around us. But he is the healer and the comforter once we do go through problems. And in the long run, many times we see that our suffering does have spiritual benefits, such as what Paul said in 2 Corinthians 12, when he said he sought God three times for deliverance. But God's answer was, "No, I'm leaving this with you." And then Paul said, "I have learned that when I am weak, then I am strong." So sometimes when we are weak physically, over time we become stronger spiritually. And that way we can have peace of mind in spite of our suffering. The kind of peace that Paul wrote about in Philippians 4, the peace which surpasses all understanding. And after we've grown spiritually and learned to how to view our trials, other people can look at our lives and be inspired by that and think, if I were going through what you're going through, I would just be torn apart completely. I would just be crushed. But yet, you have a peace which I just don't understand. And that is a gift of God, of course. Now, what is God's will? People often comment, well, was this God's will for this to happen? And that is a tough question to answer. People say, well, it must have been God's will. Well, yes and no. In one sense, it is always God's will, if you mean desire, to protect us and heal us and rescue us from all harm. I mean, that's God's heart. He loves us. He doesn't enjoy seeing anybody suffering, especially his own children. So his desire is to see us not suffer and to be delivered from suffering. So if by the word will we mean desire, then it's God's desire for us never to suffer. But if by God's will we mean his plan, then it often is God's will for us to suffer. Because part of his plan is allowing us to suffer as human beings. As excruciating as our sorrow is, I'm certain that God's sorrow is deeper than ours. That he grieves with us. I don't know if God literally sheds tears, but it's like God is shedding tears for us. He deeply sympathizes. And people who have a major trial often get angry at God. And God gets angry also. He's angry at Satan and the demons. He's angry at this evil world. He's angry at the injustice. He's angry at the cruelty and the horrible things that happen. So he shares our emotions. But to fulfill his plan, he has to allow us to go through sufferings. Now Romans 8, 8th chapter of Romans, has two very important scriptures to give us perspective on the subject of healing. Verse 18 says that, where Paul says, "I reckon that the sufferings of this life are not worthy to be compared to the glory which will be revealed to us or in us." So what are we to compare our sufferings with? We don't need to compare our sufferings with other people's sufferings. We don't need to compare our sufferings with what if, and why couldn't it be this other way. But what we do need to compare our sufferings with is the fact that when we're in the kingdom, looking back on this life, no matter how great our sufferings were, we're going to think that was a small price to pay for what God has given me now. That's the primary thing we should compare it with. And then verse 28 is where Paul wrote, "For God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, who are called by God." The thing itself is not good. He's not trying to make you do mental gymnastics and think, "Oh, well, this seems bad, but it's really good." No, it's bad. When something happens bad to you, it really is bad. But amazingly, God will help to bring about some good later on, partly as a result of that trial. Now, it has been a tragic trend all through human history. When people say, why did God allow this to happen, is to assume that it's the fault of the person suffering, that he is to blame and to be shamed by that, assuming that it's some sin or some weakness or some mistake that has brought this on. And of course, we do make mistakes. Sometimes it is because of our sins and mistakes, but people tend to assume that is much more a factor than what it really is. It's kind of a superstitious. People want to think that everything is neat and just cut and dried, and that there's always a cause and effect, and it just comes some kind of simple equation. But the Bible is full of accounts of righteous people suffering all kinds of problems. And yet, people tend to assume that, well, if things are going well, you're being blessed. And if things are not going well, well, you're being cursed for what you did wrong. Most of you have heard the song from The Sound of Music, I must have done something good. In other words, if something good is happening, it must be because I was doing something righteous and God is blessing me for it. But I'm going to turn to the opposite is often true. Is people think, well, you must have committed some sin or made some major mistake. You must be in a wrong attitude because you're being punished for that. And first of all, I'm going to turn to 1 Timothy 6, a famous passage here about the love of money is a root of all evil. And a point especially to verse 5, useless wranglings of men of corrupt minds and destitute of truth who suppose that godliness is a means of gain, from such withdraw yourself. People think that, well, my motivation for righteousness is to get God's blessings. And you know, when God has first called you, it's normal, that's all right, to have largely a selfish motive for wanting to be blessed. But carried to the extreme over the long run, if that's as far as it goes, that is pretty shallow, that I'm just going to do this just to get from God. And this is the basis of the so-called health and wealth gospel. That if you're a good person and you go to church regularly and you talk in a religious way, that God is going to do amazing things. He's going to make you healthy and wealthy and just pour out the blessings on you. What goes along with this verse is that if you are doing well, if you are very, very healthy or you're wealthy, then that health and wealth gospel appeals to you, because then it's like you feel like you're getting a pat on the back, like, well, I must be doing pretty well spiritually. God must be really pleased with me because this explains why I'm doing so well and I'm prospering. Is God is blessing me, and that must mean God approves of my life, that he likes me just the way I am right now, and that's why I'm prospering. And so that is a fundamental major error that Paul is referring to in this passage. Jesus Christ was thoroughly disgusted by this thought. When a man blind from birth asked Jesus, Rabbi, who sinned? This blind man, he was blind from birth, said, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And the answer was, neither. When people had this attitude that there are some sinners that are obviously worse just because calamities have befallen them, And this is in Luke 13. He said, do you think these people who had calamities befall them were worse sinners? He says, I tell you, no. The implication in the parable of the Good Samaritan is likely, I mean, one of the lessons that is not obvious but is a subtle implication is that the priest and the Levite pass by the injured man because they would assume that he was being punished by God. And so why should I help him? I would be trying to undo what God is doing in punishing him. He doesn't deserve to be helped. If God thinks he deserves to suffer, well, then I should let him suffer. It is a tragic thing. And then, this is illustrated so well by the book of Job. The book of Job teaches us a lot, especially about what not to assume and what not to say. Now, in Job 2, it tells us that when Job was suffering terribly, three friends showed up, and they did the ideal thing. And I'll turn to that and read that verse or two in Job 2. Because they came and sat down with him and just spent time with him and were quiet. So in Job 2, verse 11, now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, they made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him and lifted their voices and wept, and each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. This would be an ideal example if the story ended right there. So far, so good. But they just could not resist the false philosophy that people must suffer for their sins, especially if they're suffering for a long time. Maybe they thought when they showed up they were going to see him get well that week. But first of all, they came. You have to congratulate those three friends that they did some things right. First of all, they showed up. You know, coming to spend time with somebody who's suffering and who doesn't look very good is difficult. It's very uncomfortable. But they were willing to come and spend time a whole week at least. I mean, to begin with, it was a week. Who knows how long they were there with him. And then they mourned. They wept. They expressed their grief. They tore their clothes. Not that we do that today, but we have other ways of expressing the fact that we really do feel deeply about somebody else's suffering. And they made it clear that they were grieving along with him. But the story doesn't end there. Because then, especially, well, let's read the next verse. Chapter 3 and verse 1. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. So that really disturbed them that Job was saying things that didn't sound very nice, didn't sound very politically correct, it was hard for them to cope with Job's frustration and his bewilderment, his confusion, his anger, his questions. So then they began to correct him and assume one thing after another, all kinds of assumptions. And they assume that this is evidence, his suffering is evidence that you must have done bad things. You must have been committing egregious sins. And so it was accusation and speculation, accusation and speculation from then on. And this greatly added to Job's suffering, greatly added to his mental and emotional suffering. And he called them miserable comforters. Yes, they were. They added to his misery. by their wrong kind of comforting. And so this is, they had, you might say, the health and wealth gospel type thinking in their minds. And we need to ask ourselves, if I had been Job's friend at that time, what would I have done? What would I have assumed? What would I have said? What would I have not said if I had been there as Job's friend, seeing somebody suffering so terribly as he was? You know, it's not completely clear exactly what Job learned from this. As we think about it, we partly see that. But what is very clear from this story is how not to be a friend. What not to do. What the three friends should not have done. And that is to judge and to be judgmental and to speculate and to accuse and have so much skepticism about their friend Job. Well, Jesus Christ combated that not only with his words, in other words, he combated that viewpoint not only with his words, but with his actions. Jesus was regularly sort of bypassing the upper crust and those that were not suffering to spend time reaching out to the untouchables, to reach out and relate to and touch and talk to and heal and comfort the poor, the sick, the minorities, the women, the children. His example was revolutionary in that time. He set us an example, and we need to imitate that example. You know, when people assume that you must have been doing bad things or you wouldn't be suffering, that kind of accusation usually comes from people who have never suffered a lot. If you go through extreme suffering, you come face to face with the fact that people suffer when they haven't done anything to bring it on. I don't mean that they were perfect, but they realize how empty and unhelpful it is to assume that, because they have been through it themselves and they're much more sympathetic to other people who are suffering because they have been through trials like that and they don't make those shallow assumptions. You know, speculating on why something happens is unimportant, especially it's unimportant compared with giving comfort. You sure don't want to lay a guilt trip on someone. You're there to comfort, not to give a lecture or to be Mr. or Mrs. Fix-It, the white knight savior. When Jesus Christ healed people, we never read about him saying, well, you know what, you should have done this, and you could have been doing this, and do you realize why you got into this shape to begin with? And have you learned your lesson, and are you going to do better from now on? We don't know everything about what Jesus said or did not say, but we don't see that Jesus Christ, the judge of the whole world, was being judgmental. He knew when people are suffering, they don't need to hear a lecture, even though they maybe do need to learn to do some things differently. When people are suffering, that's not the time to hear a lecture. I'm going to turn to 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter. 1 Corinthians 13. And after that, chapter 12. And there's so much food for thought in these chapters. But first of all, in the first three verses, we see that love is more important than anything else. Those people that stay at home on the Sabbath and are not really reaching out to others, they may be getting really smart. They may be getting a lot of theology in their minds, but they're not fully showing love. So we see what the priorities are in the first three verses. And then down in verse 12, "For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face." In other words, there is so much we cannot know in this life. God doesn't reveal everything to us. If you ask God why, God's not going to speak to you and say, "Okay, here's all my reasons." He allows us to be somewhat in the dark about all of His considerations, but we just have to trust Him and go on and make sure that we're building our relationship with God. One of my favorite sayings that I've ever heard is the saying that people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. They don't need a lot of even theology to impress you, impress them. But before they want to listen to you, they want to first know that you really care about them. And that's one reason people listen to Jesus Christ. They could tell He really, really cared about them. People need a shoulder to cry on, not a finger to point at them. They need to hold hands and to have a hug and some comforting words. Verse 4 of this chapter says, "Love suffers long. Love is willing to be self-sacrificing and patient and giving rather than choosing to do what you selfishly would like to be doing." Now back in chapter 12, most of this chapter 12 is emphasizing the need for unity and harmony and closeness and teamwork and working together in love as a body of Christ. And so there's a tremendous amount of emphasis on that. That's what God wants to see. And He emphasizes that when one part of a body suffers, you feel the suffering all over. And likewise, that's the way we should feel when we know that one of our fellow members is suffering. So let me read verses 24 through 26. Starting in the middle, "But God composed the body, having given greater honor to the part which lacks it, that there should be no schism, no division in the body, but that the members should have the same care for one another, as much care for others as themselves." And verse 26 says, "And if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. Or if one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it." It doesn't mean that you pretend to suffer, or that you pretend to be honored, that you genuinely feel those things in your heart. You know, Matthew 5, one of the Beatitudes is, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." Do we really mourn when other people are suffering? Numerous scriptures say that Jesus, when He saw people suffering, He was moved with compassion. He was moved with compassion. We need to be moved with compassion when we see others suffering. At the last Passover, Jesus washed the disciples' feet. He didn't give them a lecture on why are your feet dirty. Now I'll turn to Romans 12. Romans 12, one of my favorite chapters and probably yours too. Romans 12, there's so much about how we should feel toward one another and how we should treat one another in this chapter. In verse 10 it says, "Kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love and honor, giving preference to one another." And then going down to verse 13, "Distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another," which means in a modern translation, live in harmony and unity with one another. Do not set your mind on high things. That means selfish things and things that are going to benefit you, or just want to associate with people who have more to give to you, that are more interesting or give you more entertainment. And then, so be not wise in your own opinion. Don't be conceited. And verse 18, if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Now I want to go back to the verse 15. This doesn't mean pretend to rejoice with those who rejoice. Do you really honestly feel joy at somebody else's joy? It doesn't mean pretend to be weeping on the inside when someone is weeping. Do you really feel like weeping when somebody else is suffering? So this is not just a pretend thing. It doesn't say anything to go with that. It doesn't say weep and give advice, or weep and give them a lecture. This is a good definition of empathy. Empathy is going beyond just sympathy. It is feeling and experiencing in your heart and in your emotions and mind what someone else is feeling. It's interesting that the word empathy and sympathy and compassion, they all come from the root word pathos or passion. And the word pathos, I think it was a Greek word that means pain or suffering. And passion can mean that as well. And the word S-Y-N or S-Y-M means together. So sympathy means, together with pathos, means suffer with. Now remember, part of the title of this sermon is how to give comfort and how not to give comfort. Much of my preparation for this sermon was done way back in 2007 when this subject was very much on my mind, and I wrote two articles for United News that came out in two successive issues of the United News. One was titled Supporting Those Who Are Sick, What and What Not to Think, Say, and Do. The next one was Supporting Those Who Are Sick, Advice to Give and Not Give. Now, I'm not getting much into that subject in this message. That would be a subject we might want to give later as well. That article was mostly about when you see someone who is sick. A very common problem in the church, well, not just in the church, but also in the church, is that the person tends to receive a ton of all kinds of advice about, well, why don't you try this, or try my medical treatment, or try my doctor, or try my diet, or try my supplement, or do this or do that. All kinds of advice, unasked for advice. And it adds to the burden often of a person who is suffering. We're all human, and it's so easy to feel inadequate or uncomfortable around someone else who's suffering. To go visit somebody in a hospital, or stuck at home, or in a nursing home, or going to a funeral, these things are not fun. They're not entertaining. And so human nature is we want to go where we feel more comfortable. There's a old saying, smile and the world smiles with you. Cry and you cry alone. Because most people just tend to shun you if you're suffering, because that doesn't make them feel good. A similar saying is, smile and the world smiles with you. Frown and the world frowns upon you. Frown and the world frowns upon you. In other words, you shouldn't be frowning. Be like me. Smile. Yeah, I know you're suffering, but, you know, you've had a day to frown, so get over it. So if you go to spend time with somebody who's suffering, they know you care. Don't neglect the sick. In Hebrews 10, where it says, "Do not forsake the assembling of yourselves together," that doesn't mean just at church services. We need to assemble with people wherever they are, especially when they need support and comfort. I'm going to turn to Ecclesiastes 7. Ecclesiastes 7. It's a very thought-provoking section. It says, "A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart." It does our hearts good to go to the house of mourning. We're going to learn more that way than we are going to the house of feasting. Verse 3, "Sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better." And that's one reason why God lets us suffer and lets our friends and loved ones suffer. Verse 4, "The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth." In other words, it's a fool who just only will go to the house of mirth. Like 1 Corinthians 12 taught us, people who are weak need more attention, not less attention. Remember, Jesus Christ said, "The good shepherd is those who leave the 99 who are healthy, and they spend however much time it takes to reach out to and find and rescue the one lamb that strayed away, or that was weak, or that was in danger, or hurting, or injured." Of course, when you go to visit people, you know, be practical. You've got to be alert to how tired or how ill the person is. You can't, if you go to visit somebody, you have to be careful not to stay too long, of course. Now, sometimes a big need is just physical help. In 1 John 3, it says to lay down our lives for the brethren. And it says if you have ways to help physically, but all you do is just utter a few words, then shame on you when you could have met an important physical need, like bringing food or running errands or mowing the lawn or babysitting or so many things that people need when they're going through a crisis or they're homebound or they're sick or something like that. James, the second chapter, talks about this also. It speaks of faith without works is dead. And one of the examples James uses is those that say, "Oh, be warmed and filled." In other words, a nice little cliche, platitude. I'll say something that sounds nice, but that's all the person does. "Oh, get well soon. Bye-bye." Galatians 6 says we must bear one another's burdens. And you bear one another's burdens, first of all, by being there for them. Now I'm going to turn to Matthew 25, a section we're very familiar with, but it's powerful. You know, when you first come in the church, when God's first calling you, God is really pleased when you break bad habits. You know, when you quit getting drunk and you quit cursing and you start keeping the Sabbath and you quit keeping the pagan holidays, God is really pleased. But once you've developed the right habits in place of the bad habits, what is God looking for? How is He judging you then? So here in Matthew 25, verse 34, "Then the king will say to those on his right hand, 'Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Those are a few important examples right there. It's more than just saying a few nice words. Now, you don't want to push yourself on somebody, though. You want to be sensitive. You don't want to create discomfort. You don't want to push their boundaries and be invasive or intrusive into their lives or presumptuous. Of course, you've got to keep those things in mind. Let's talk about the power of words now, for good and bad. The power of words. What should I say? Whatever you say doesn't need to be lengthy. It doesn't have to be real special or complex or profound. Just saying something very simple like, I am so, so sorry. Or what a devastating thing to happen. Or I feel heartbroken for you. Or I'm praying. I want you to know I'm really praying for you. And I'm thinking, I'm planning to fast for you. But more important than what we say usually is learning to be a good listener. I mean a really attentive listener. A listener who's sensitive and responsive and sympathetic and empathetic. Who's paying close attention to everything a suffering person says. And doesn't try to counteract or to change the subject. When I was 11, my 3.5-year-old brother died. And for months, whenever my mother was with any of her friends, she wanted to talk about little Roddy. She wanted to hold on to the memories, and one way to hold on to the memories was to talk about the memories. All the good memories. And, of course, often tears would well up in her eyes. And most people would look uncomfortable. And instead of being responsive, they would either act bored or they would act just obviously uncomfortable. And sometimes they would even change the subject. Or they would say, oh, well, try not to think about it. That is the last thing she wanted to hear. That's what she wanted to think about. But people often, even though they don't have bad intentions, yet they're more concerned about making themselves feel comfortable than helping the person who's the victim, who's suffering. And some people think my job is to cheer people up. I'll turn to Proverbs 27 and verse 14. This kind of illustrates it. Proverbs 27 and verse 14 says, he who blesses his friend with a loud voice rising early in the morning, it will be counted a curse to him. It's kind of a... And then chapter 25 and verse 20. It says, like one who takes away a garment in cold weather and the vinegar on... And like vinegar on soda is one who sings songs to a heavy heart. That is not grieving with a person. Oh, let's put on some happy music. Let me tell you some jokes to cheer you up. Now, when I talk about the harmful effects of words, I don't mean anything intentional. Of course, we wouldn't do something trying to hurt somebody. But we can say something with good intentions that, because we haven't really thought it through, is hurtful. And that's what I want to talk about. First of all, don't say, I know how you feel. No, you don't. Especially if you haven't been through exactly the same trial. But even if you have been through a very similar trial, you're a different person. And you don't really know how the person feels. Now, you can say something like, oh, I can only imagine how you must feel. But don't claim that you really know how they feel. And don't start telling your own war stories. This is a common mistake. Oh, I understand how you feel because let me tell you about what I went through, which is kind of similar. And so let me tell you this long story about all the things I've been through. Now, the person already feels a heavy burden of sorrow. And now you're telling more sad stories as if, well, you need to feel sorry for me because of what I went through in the past. I'm going to talk about platitudes. A platitude is a cliche. It's a simple little saying that sounds good on the surface, but it might be true and it might not be true. It is usually not altogether true. It's something that's often half true. It's something that can, even though it may technically be have truth in it, it has a bad effect. Now, I've divided a bunch of platitudes up into three categories. One type is defending God, the second type is giving advice, and the third type is minimizing or downplaying the trial of the other person. Now, especially if the victim is complaining, this is not fair. Why would God do this? I've begun to question God. The person feels like, oh man, I've got to straighten this person out. I've got to defend God. I've got to correct his errors in his thinking. Or if he's feeling angry at God, well then, oh, I've got to force him to quit being angry. And because there's errors in his thinking. Well, if you read the Bible, David got angry at God. A lot of people got angry at God. Job got angry at God. Interesting thing is we never read about God correcting somebody for that. How dare you get angry at me? We just don't read that. God understands that that's normal and he's patient. And he knows the grieving process involves going through all kinds of emotional stages, including doubt and confusion and anger and depression and all of those things. And so God knows you need time to work through those things. So people want to have their own little theology lesson. Like they've got to defend God. Things like, well, God is in control. God's in charge. It must have been God's will. Well, what about this being Satan's world? The implication of these things can be, well, God did this to you. How can God be a loving God when he made you sick or he killed your loved one? Or God knows best. Or God must have a purpose for this to have happened. Well, it just must have been his time to go. Or I guess God was just done working with him or her. Or it was just meant to be. Or it just wasn't meant to be. That implies fatalism, like predestination. Que sera, sera, as they say in Spanish. Whatever will be, will be. It's all in the cards. It's in the stars. Well, maybe this is just a blessing in disguise. Well, these are half-truths, and they're very faulty and simplistic. You know, God can take our emotions. You know, Job said things that were wrong to an extent. But at the end of the book, God wasn't correcting Job. What God was really upset about was a lack of comfort by the friends. Okay, the second type of platitude is giving advice. You know, somebody's really suffering. It's a very, very bad time to be giving advice. Like, maybe you just need more faith. Well, what about all the people with very strong faith, like in Hebrews 11, who suffered greatly and died young? or were tortured, or were martyred, or we'll just leave it in God's hands, or don't worry, just pray about it, or try not to think about it, or try to think about all your blessings, all the good things that are happening in your life. Try to see what lessons you can learn from this. Well, try to get over it. It's time to move on. Or giving health or medical advice, like that's a whole subject in itself. If you'd eat what I eat, if you take the supplements I take, if you'd use the natural alternative health measures that I use, you know, you'd get over this right away. Or don't forget, the Bible tells us to rejoice in our trials. People need a shoulder to cry on, not a finger of judgmental accusation and advice. By the way, as I was working on this sermon a little over a week ago, I stopped by to buy some greeting cards so that I have some on hand for sending people. You know, I'm looking for all kinds, you know, like sympathy cards, get well cards, miss you cards, happy birthday cards. It really struck me that at least 90% of the sympathy cards were wording that I did not like. It's the very thing I'm talking about. Many greeting cards have just some platitude which can be taken in a negative way and may be more irritating and discouraging and than comforting. It may have more bad effects than good effects. So let's all be very careful, even when we buy a commercial greeting card, about the wording. Is this wording that God really approves of? Now, if somebody looks you right in the eye and says, "Why did God let this happen?" Just because they're asking you doesn't mean you need to give an answer. Why should you think you have the answer? I mean, the person is searching for answers, but don't think that you've got to come up with some reason. You just have to say, "I don't know. I do not know." It does seem very unfair for something so bad to happen to a good person like you. A third type of platitude is minimizing or downplaying the extent of the trial. And because you want to make them feel better, it's like, "Well, I'm going to say a few words and they're instantly going to feel better. And it's going to make me feel better because I feel uncomfortable facing up to how severe this trial is." If you imply, "Well, you're just too sorrowful. You're too depressed. You're just rubbing salt in the wound. You're creating an additional hurt." So to say things like, "Oh, well, you'll rise above this," or "I know God will give you comfort," or "Despite this, I'm sure you can feel God's love and His comfort," or "God will hold your hand through this," or "Your trial could have been a lot worse," or "Think about all the people in the world who are suffering even worse things than you," or "You're strong, you'll get through this," or "You'll get over it eventually," or "When this trial is over," or "If you think that is bad, let me tell you what I went through." There are many types of suffering that people never get over. The pain diminishes over time, but there's many sorrows that people never get completely over. And God really doesn't intend for them to get over it. I had not gotten over the death of my little brother back when I was 11. So platitudes are not comforting. It's better to say nothing than to be saying some platitude. So you don't need to say much of anything because there just are no words that match up to the sorrow. But your being there and your presence and you're letting them know that you are suffering along with them. Because you care so much about the person, you too are suffering. That means a lot. One thing that worries me about giving this sermon, though, is that it can scare you into thinking, oh man, it's so easy to say the wrong thing that I'm afraid to go try. I'm afraid to go visit somebody or to send a card or write a note or call on the phone or visit somebody because I might say the wrong thing. Well, just remember to think before you speak. And if you don't know what is something really good to say, just be there. Just say, I'm thinking about you, praying about you. I'm deeply, deeply sorry. And let me know if there's what I can do. And if they say, oh, nothing. You know, a lot of people don't like to accept help because they don't think you really want to help. But if you start saying, well, I really do want to help. Is there anything I can do? Or start making suggestions. Can I do this? Can I do that? Can I bring you some food? Can I run an errand? Can I give you a ride somewhere? The people can tell who really cares. You know, if you're the victim, don't spend much time looking backwards, you know, wondering about all the things that led up to that or what mistakes I've made or why did God let this happen. You need to focus on the present and on the future. Okay, now that this has happened, now what am I going to do? How am I going to react? How can I try to make this work together for good? Or at least how can I gain wisdom from this? And how can I go on and be a servant to others? I don't want to let my trial cause me to shrink back into a shell and just make me become bitter and want to run away from people. But I want to take the pain and the sorrow and the grief and the wisdom that I've gained that will better equip me to be a comforter, a servant to others. And certainly there's healing in that. As you help heal other people, it helps to heal yourself. Don't focus on why did God let this happen, but now more than ever, I need God. I need God in my life to comfort me and to guide me and to guide my thoughts and to heal me and hold my hand. So that's more of what we should think about in regard to our relationship with God. God is not the helicopter God who's an invisible shield, whose purpose is to keep all bad things from happening to you. But God is there that no matter what you're going through, whether it's happy times or terrible times, He's there to be with you and to guide you and to comfort you and to guide your thoughts and all of that. I'm going to turn to Hebrews 4, very comforting place here. Hebrews 4, beginning in verse 14. Seeing then when we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. He was tempted and tested and tried and suffered all kinds of things. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace that we might obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. We come to the throne of God not to say, take away all my problems, but give me the strength and guidance and right attitudes and right thoughts and comfort and healing that I need now to be able to go on, to keep going forward, and to have a right relationship with you, and to have a loving relationship with all my brothers and sisters in Christ, with my family. I think we've all heard the poetic story called Footprints in the Sand by Mary Stevenson, and I'm just going to paraphrase it. In a dream, he saw two sets of footprints in the sand. One set was his, and he knew the other set was the Lord. And then he spoke to the Lord and said, I realized that it was at the most difficult times of my life, when I was very much suffering, the saddest, lowest points in my life, that there was only one set of footprints. Why did you leave me? Why did you forsake me just when I needed you the most? And the Lord answered that that was not when I left you. I would never forsake you. That was when I was carrying you. It doesn't... You know, there's several things I like about this little story. One is that the person doesn't ask the Lord, why did you let this happen? Why did you let all these bad things happen to me? Or why didn't you protect me from those things? But he asked the right question. Why were you not with me? But that was just his misunderstanding. God had not protected him from the trials, but God was closer than ever. God was weeping with him and carrying him. Well, that's what we need to remember, that God will be there for you. And God has called us to be his hands and arms to a great extent, and his mouthpieces. A major way that God shows his love is through his people. He wants to work through us. And a major way is by us being comforters, comforting one another in our trials and sorrows. In fact, if a person has gone through a major trial, he needs to go through the very stages of grief. It takes time. It can't happen overnight. It's a long, slow process. And it's tough. But we can be there with them and for them. And sorrow along with them.